when new generations come around, there is a lot of hype around new Pokemon. There's quite a lot of deserved hype. Gen 4 Garchomp, for example, actually surpassed the outrageous excitement around it. Then there's the hype for Pokemon that wind up being terrible, like Electivire. You know what's interesting though? When a Pokemon seems like it's going to be amazing, yet isn't quite amazing, but it's not bad. In fact, it's pretty decent. Maybe even very good. It's just not quite the elite beast early expectations placed upon it. We're covering 10 of these Pokemon today, giving us some Pokemon we don't get to examine that much. That's right, no Reshiram, no Zoroark, and yes, no Electivire. We've got an axe to grind with our first choice, with Haxorus. When Generation 5 came out, its immediate perception was viewed through the lens of the standards set by Generation 4, especially seeing as Gen 5 looked to be a continuation of that. Meaning, for all the fancy new weather shenanigans, the scariest Pokemon were still going to be Dragon types, and this wound up being very much true. Much of Generation 4 had been characterized by overwhelming Dragon spam, and the memories of the bans of Latias and controversially Salamence were very fresh in the player base's minds, which is why their eyes instantly jumped to the new dragons Gen 5 had unleashed. These were players who had just been bombarded by Salamence's base 135 attack outrage. Now imagine the disbelieving existential terror when they realized they were going to not only have to go through this again with Haxorus, originally known by its Japanese name Ononokusu, but so much worse. Base 135? This thing's base attack is base 147. It's a level of power that remains outstanding today. In Generation 5, it was ludicrously tantamount to US foreign policy, taking inspiration from Bugs Bunny or the plot of Inherent Vice. It simply made no sense. This thing was almost as strong as one of the new box legendaries, Zekrom. And it wasn't even the pseudo-legendary either. Haxorus's outrage wasn't just quite a bit stronger than Groudon's Earthquake either. And this was no Rampardos theorem waiting to happen. While it wasn't quite at Mensa's base 100 benchmark, it was quite close, coming in at a very solid base 97. This was miles faster than renowned Dragon-type Dragon Knight, for instance. Haxorus also wasn't frail. It actually had quite good natural physical bulk, and its mono Dragon-typing meant that it lacked a quadruple ice weakness. So even something as strong as Life Orb Mamoswine's Ice Shard would never KO it after Stealth Rock, while it was hardly a target for one-hit KOs from a myriad of Hidden Power Ices either. Oh, and back to the power thing. It not only got Dragon Dance, but Swords Dance? It was like some sort of absurd cross between Garchomp and Rayquaza, whose outrageous Haxorus nearly matched in power and made Garchomp look like a UU Pokemon in comparison. Haxorus seemed designed to make sure defensive teams would never stand a chance. Oh, and it's also got Mold Breaker Earthquake to ignore Bronzong's Levitate, and it can taunt Skarmory. Not that it needs to do either of those things, seeing as it can actually threaten them. Yes, even Skarmory, through the sheer power of its super boosted outrage. What in the world is going on, everyone wondered. If competitive singles was a real life thing, you'd have seen players running and screaming through the streets in great terror and agony than the most horrendously timed crit para full para, at least in those first days. So, what happened? Haxorus certainly didn't get the Gen 4 Salamence treatment. It was never considered for Ubers at all. Even after the more openly obscene elements of the tier's early stages, the Darkrai's and Blazikens, were removed. Now, this is not to say it was bad or a disappointment. In fact, throughout Black and White 1, Haxorus was very good. Its double dance set was killer on hyper offense, and it mercilessly destroyed dominant rain stalls like little else. But it really came into its own with the choice band set that defined and legitimized Dragmag as a playstyle, making it one of the metagame's most dangerous team choices for some time. Black and White 2 came around and basically created Mega Haxorus in the form of Kyurem Black, which, well, you have to be careful to not show that base 170 attack stat to any elderly Gen 4 players out of concern for their health. If base 147 was already insane beyond belief, well, that aside, Haxorus was a dangerous threat and has gone on to have a solid competitive career. However, anything less than a swift boot to Ubers crashes in the face of the mass hysteria of those early days. If you time traveled to that period and told someone that this would go on to be a two-time member of UU and would also twice land in RU, they might actually go full on insane we live in a society joker mode. And the wildest part of all, Haxorus wasn't even the only dragon asking the early Gen 5 player base if they want to know how it got these scars, as it clearly got them from the next Pokemon on our list with Hydreigon. But before we start, we want to talk about a brand new MMO action RPG, Crystal of Atlan. Crystal of Atlan is a cross-platform Mage Punk themed MMO with a huge emphasis on combat. On top of looking phenomenally graphically, it's got fluid controls that give an exhilarating feeling while fighting. There's a ton of combos that you'll be able to master, as well as 17 classes to choose from and 20 skills for each class. There's a ton of game modes too, ranging from 4-player raids to 8-player dungeons and even PvP. And for a limited time, Crystal of Atlan is partnering with Digimon Adventures. Yes, you heard that right, Digimon, on this channel. You'll get your free pet Gatomon, and you can also get Agumon, and fight off against Machinedramon in either solo or 4-player raid battle. You'll also receive a cool mount of either Garurumon or his mega form, Metal Garurumon. Plus, there are tons of other free rewards waiting for you, like the collab avatar frame, collab title, and icons. So if you want one of the best MMO action RPGs I've ever seen, and also support the channel to help us produce more content, go to our link in the description below and start playing Digimon Adventure X Crystal Atlan. The crossover event is available from August 21st to September 17th. Once again, this new dragon was also opening up the deep, fresh psychological wounds that Salamence had left on the player base. But whereas Haxorus made these previously overwhelming base 135 outrages seem quaint by comparison, Hydreigon would do the same for Dracometeor, which remember, was still 140 base power pre-Gen 6. Now, Hydreigon didn't quite reach the same astronomical base attacking stat, but it didn't need to. The benchmark was base 110 special attack, as that was what both Latias and Salamence had rocked OU with, and which was still quite strong. Heck, Dragapult does a great job with 130 base power Draco and 100 base special attack in Gens 8 and 9. Hydreigon, though, left Latias and Salamence's base 110 in the dust at base 125. It was actually approaching the newly freed Latios' power level. It was also rife with other excellent qualities that terrified the player base for how they flipped common responses to these dragons on their heads. The Lati twins were famously pursuit weak, and its secondary dark typing, Hydreigon, resists pursuit, so forget that. Salamence was known for getting worn down quickly. Thanks to its stealth rock weakness, Hydreigon was nice and neutral. While it wasn't Ment's level fast, it was still quite good. Coming in at, and there's no way the jokesters at Game Freak didn't do this on purpose, base 98, meaning it outpaced Haxorus by 1 point. Speaking of Haxorus, it did provide a similar level of power on the special side, despite the much lower attacking stat, thanks to Dracometeor's 20 base power points over Outrage. In fact, Hydreigon's Draco hit a bit harder than Haxorus's Outrage, and did so without locking its user in to boot. Hydreigon seemed like a superb cross between Salamence and the Lati. It didn't have Salamence's talent for mixed attacking, but it destroyed everything besides Blissey and Chansey with special moves, and the pink blobs were stifled by taunt. Hydreigon's move pool was uniquely amazing for a Pokemon of its kind. This thing was packing U-turn, as if it wasn't hard enough to check already by pushing that classic dragon strategy of annihilating steals with coverage and annihilating everything else with Dracometeor to a new level that was both powerful and difficult to punish. People were terrified of this new age mix mess. The fear that this was another Uber wasn't as intense as the bug-eyed terror over Haxorus, but it generally seemed like where Haxorus went, Hydreigon would soon follow, following the freshly remembered Latias ban followed by Salamence ban only a few months previously. So, what happened? Well, Hydreigon was no slouch, and it indeed was one of the most terrifying wall breakers in OU. Unlike Haxorus, it actually improved in Black and White 2 upon receiving Roost for longevity, as well as superpower to pull off a Dragonite-style mix attacking. It also repeatedly evolved its game, going from classic mix to taunt Roost sets with leftovers and dark pulse to take on threats like Jellicent, Reuniclus, and Mew, to Choice Scarf sets catching Scarf Lander's Therion off guard, to all out Choice Specs dropping a Draco that was actually stronger than Latios's because Hydreigon could afford to run a special attack boosting nature. However, Uber it was not. This idea simply did not exist at all past those first chaotic days. The Haxorus Hydreigon 1-2 punch definitely sent Gen 4 players on an emotional roller coaster adjusting to Gen 5. But actually, there had been a similar phenomenon with Gen 3 players when Gen 4 came out and provided a seemingly bonkers evolution with Rhyperior. Rhydon had been a ferocious threat since the beginning of competitive Pokemon. It was tied for the second highest base attack in the game in the first two gens, only behind the pseudo-legends Dragonite and Tyranitar, and packed a base HP stat of 105. Not only was this well ahead of the base 100 that was already considered very, very high, it also clocked in almost as high as Mewtwo, Lugia, and Hoenn's base 106. Base 105 is so high, in fact, that it is still well out of the ordinary today. Rhydon also brandished excellent base 120 defense, which, alongside the outstanding HP, made it one of the physically bulkiest Pokemon in the game, and could use this alongside its normal resistance and electric immunity to hit the field and smack the opponent with its powerful B beautifully complementary stab combination of Earthquake and Rock Slide. Okay, so it was slow and destroyed by special move, especially since it had some really exploitable weaknesses, most notably its quadruple weakness to water and grass. But this was simply the cost of doing business, and it was a price well worth paying. It was elite in Gen 1, solid in Gen 2, and though it fell off quite a bit in Gen 3, it still had a niche. Put simply, Rhydon was a fully formed Pokemon. As such, when it gained an evolution in Gen 4, there was slight panic. Modern Gen players can relate. Remember when you discovered that Bisharp of all things was getting an evolution? How can they push that already powerful Pokemon further? That's what it was like when Rhyperior came around. The thing was basically Rhydon, but more. And that's exactly what was so scary about it. The speed stat had remained the same, but who cares? Because remember how Rhydon's HP stat was already above and beyond? While Rhyperior was coming in hot at a staggering base 115. Meanwhile, its defense jumped up to base 130, meaning Rhyperior had Lugia's defense and a lot more HP. Its attack rocketed up to base 140, and the rock slide it used for stab previously was now a far more vicious, if inaccurate, Stone Edge. Even its special defense was boosted slightly. Oh, and Rhyperior's ability was solid rock, so even if you hit it super effectively, the damage would be reduced to 75% of its original capacity, and rock types now gained a special defense boost in Sandstorm. Players were up in arms. How do you beat this thing? Well, the same way you'd always dealt with Rhydon. Yes, Rhyperior was far more well equipped to handle his weak points, but those weak points were still as difficult to manage as they were abundant, especially as it was just so slow. And no, its newly gained rock polish didn't do much to quell that issue. If you told someone at the beginning of the generation that Rhyperior would wind up in UU, not in some theoretical crazy power creep future gen where Mewtwo can barely manage to hold on to its OU status, but in the same generation, they would look at you as if you just suggested date night at a federal penitentiary. But indeed, Rhyperior well to UU was nowhere near overwhelming in the water and grass heavy metagame. Rhyperior was far from bad, of course. Not only did it thrive in UU, but it also had a genuinely terrifying OU niche if supported correctly. Still, it was far from the rock wrecker expected in its early days, somewhat akin to one of the legendaries also introduced in that generation with Cresselia. Lugia had finally arrived in OU. Such was the sentiment upon players' glimpse of Cresselia. Suicune had been compared to Lugia before, but Cresselia came by comparison more legitimately. Not only did it outbulk Suicune's base 100 HP and 115 defenses by a mile, with jaw-dropping base 120 HP and defense alike, as well as base 130 special defense, it packed non-rest recovery in the form of Moonlight, and its psychic typing recalled Lugia's fighting resist, which was particularly important in the generation that had introduced close combat. In some ways, Crest was even harder to take down than Lugia, as it wasn't weak to Stealth Rock or Common Rock or Ice covers used by fighting types. In early Diamond and Pearl, the Scar and Bliss combination's immense walling power was loathed by many more casual players. Demands for no Scar and Bliss weren't uncommon. There was a saving grace, though. Scar and Bliss was utterly eviscerated by everyone's favorite new starter, Infernape. However, when Scar and Bliss was joined by Cresselia, these players really lost their minds. This was looked at as incredibly cheap. How can you break through broken Scar and Bliss when they're paired with the perfect counter to the one thing that beats them? This informal Scar and Bliss clause was taken a step further by many. No Scar and Bliss Crest read the demands of many players looking to battle. Of course, this was quite a casualist perspective, but it was uniquely present and even at the highest levels of competition. Cresselia's walling ability was renowned for how it took on a myriad new dangers like the hyper broken Garchomp. This didn't last though, and OU's Lugia wound up not even lasting in OU. For all its incredible hit taking, Cresselia had many of Lugia's flaws. It was quite weak and passive in how it played, but more importantly, it struggled to function in the world dominated by Tyranitar. Not only was it pursuit weak, T-Tar's presence hampered its recovery, with Moonlight only restoring a paltry 25% under Sun. The fact that Moonlight had a mere 8 PP didn't help at all. As such, Crest fell to UU. It was far from a bad Pokemon, of course, as it utterly destroyed UU and got banned, and maintained several interesting niches in OU, many of them centered around its signature move, Lunar Dance, which restored PP to the Pokemon it healed, and thus made it a legitimate alternative to Healing Wish. Crest was actually at its best in Ubers, where its walling ability was finally able to shine. It paired with Groudon's Eternal Sun to make for a Moonlight that healed a stunning 66% a pop, which, alongside its lack of a Stealth Rock weakness, made it absolutely impossible to KO, allowing it to answer even Ubers' most uncounterable terrors like Rayquaza. Still, Cresselia didn't quite live up to the suggestion of its walling ability being so complete it required a clause to allow it for fair play. Now we're going to jump ahead to Generation 8 with Obstagoon, who gave the Zigzagoon Linoon line some life after being relegated to punchlines about early game fodder for so long. Recall Rich Boy Winston using a full restore on his level 7 Zigzagoon. Game Freak's masterful commentary on the pervasively vacuous perniciousness of gratuitous it as well. Now, Obstacoon was poised to dish out some seriously frightening offense. It packed a uniquely destructive stab combination, with Flame Orb activating both its Guts ability and Facade's extra power. It had 140 base power to toss around, flanked by one of the best moves in the game for its other stab in knockoff. That's not all. With close combat, it's got amazing fighting coverage and a move so strong, it comes close to approximating a third stab. It's still got a fourth move slot left over too, and that just enhances the terror of the first three. Bulk Up launches the power to unwallable threats. It's got excellent coverage in Ice and Fire Punch, and it can even go beyond all-out damage if it chooses to switcheroo its Flame Orb over an opponent once it's activated, ruining its switch-ins even more. Heck, it can even throw out a parting shot if it wants. This embarrassment of riches that constitutes its bombardment of the opponent is coming off of a solid base 95 speed, and what's more, it's hardly a glass cannon. Obstagoon has quite respectable natural bulk, and it packs one of the rarest, most invaluable defensive traits any Pokemon can ask for, a Ghost Immunity. So, what happened? Obstagoon was actually very popular in early Gen 8 OU, and it seemed like it was the real deal. It possessed the unique trait of turning Dragapult, of all things, into an avenue for its own blistering offense. Sadly, it tapered off over time, and not just because of the eventual expanded Pokedex making it less impressive by comparison. It didn't even need the comparison for players to realize that it couldn't quite deliver and execute on the level that it wanted to. It's got an impressive arsenal of power, while it's coming off of a base 90 attack. This isn't necessarily an indictment on its own, though. After all, Dracovish and its comically OP Fishious Wrens were also coming off of a base 90, but Dracovish was a one-hit kill machine, and Obstagoon, while certainly very strong, was not, which it really needed to be. Its decent natural hit-taking ability was severely impeded by the fact that the Flame Orb that it needed for Guts would actively wear it down. Sure, it was only 6.25% at a time, but it makes a world of difference compared to, you know, taking no damage at all. It wasn't so bulky that it could overcome this, nor did it have something like the healing of Stab Drain Punch that a Guts Conkeldurr might. So Obstagoon's hit-taking is undermined by how it needs to wear itself down to activate its power. Power which doesn't transform it into the one-hit KO machine it needs to be. And it's not even that fast. This would have been its saving grace. It's certainly a far cry from slow, but it doesn't even break the base 100 barrier, and that really doesn't cut it. Obstagoon's promise faded as it redesigned itself from its early days breaking through Ferrothorn and Toxapex to a career in the lower tiers. It's a very potent Pokemon, getting banned from RU, but well, it's somewhat reminiscent of another physical attacker in two different guises with Gallade and Mega Gallade. Medicham had its niche in its debut Generation 3. In recent times, it actually moved up to OU proper, but for all its mystifying powerful attack, it could struggle with consistency. Even when Gen 4 came along, with the frustrations of a pre-130 BP buff High Jump Kick and its less powerful alternatives that seemed to betray Medicham's power for the actual damage they dealt, but you wouldn't have to navigate these hindrances in Gen 4 anymore, because there was a new psychic fighting type on the block ready to dish out pain without the required restraint holding back immediacy plaguing the labyrinth maze that was dealing with Medicham's many ills. Gallade wasn't quite as powerful, but at base 125, going much more would be overkill, and more importantly, it had close combat. This alone was a huge advantage that had people excited, but Gallade had so many other incredible tools, more than it could possibly cram into one moveset. Swords Dance was major, of course, turning its CC into a Skarmory squashing super attack that left Medicham in the dust. It also was a uniquely excellent form of priority in Shadow Sneak, giving it super effective coverage against the faster Ghosts and Psychics that would try to check it. Good luck, Gengar. It had great special defense too, unlike the paper-thin Machamp. Indeed, Gallade was quite a threat, but the early hype around it didn't last, seeing how close the close combat competition wound up being. Gallade was fierce to be sure, beyond just its obligatory obliteration of Yuyu. During the brief period of its usage mandated tenure in the tier, its unique traits came together to form a strong niche in OU. With many an excellent option to disrupt standard teams in unique ways, they were often ill-prepared for. What really makes Gallade stand out, though, is how the same treatment came with its Mega Form in Gen 6, where it basically repeated its base form's Gen 4 routine. With all the Mega competition running around, Gallade wasn't on many people's minds, especially because what else? Medicham had gotten one of the most terrifying Megas of all. Mega Gallade shattered Yuyu to spectacular effect, and eventually found itself with a unique niche in OU on certain hyper offense teams, utilizing its newfound bulk as a primary advantage over Medicham. But you'd think, when first seeing Mega Gallade, the fact that it now had a speed set on par with Latios would be enough. Mega Gallade also has knockoff, much to the envy of Medicham, but Mega Gallade, good as it is not the manifestation of the one-hit KO that Mega Medicham and his high jump kick are. And speaking of Pokemon that were let down twice in Gens 4 and 6, we have Togekiss. Finally, Misty's Togepi could evolve all the way to a good good competitive Pokemon. Togekiss, for all the blandness of its normal flying typing, had a lot to like. Its Stab Air Slash and its Serene Grace doubled flinch rate were especially nasty, not just because of its high base special attack, but because of the nasty plot that could then boost it further, meaning it needs to flinch you a lot less, if at all. Both offensively and defensively, it was blessed with Flamethrower or Fire Blast and Aura Sphere to smash most flying resist, alongside a hefty bulk on both sides of the spectrum, reinforced by recovery from Roost and a whole host of utility moves. Thunder Wave to make its Air Slashes even scarier, Heal Bell to help its teammates and allow it to dominate Blissey that thought it could just Toxic and win, even Trick for a Choice Scarf set. Still, for all the threat that it posed to be ruinous on a scale that made Ironhead Jirachi look mildly irritating, it struggled to make good on the threat as much as it'd like. Its weakness to Stealth Rock was more than your average inconvenience, especially coupled with its average speed that Paralysis couldn't always compensate for. It couldn't fit everything onto its moveset either, and while its defensive profile was generally solid, it also didn't quite cover enough, nor was its switch inconsistency sufficient to make it a Pokemon that you consistently want to add to a team. Plus, with Air Slash's lower base power, it just didn't hit hard enough fast enough, and with the speed issue, you couldn't exactly flinch your way out. The normal typing, while actually helpful for letting it take on Gengar, generally meant it felt like it needed something a little bit more to launch it into consistency. And then in Gen 6, it got exactly that, where its normal type was replaced with possibly the best type in the game, the newly added Fairy type. Suddenly, on top of all its other benefits, Togekiss was Dragon immune, quadruple resistant to fighting, and resistant to dark. Some were extremely enthusiastic about this, and championed Togekiss as a great new Pokemon. But once again, the lack of immediate power and the middling speed and the Stealth Rock weakness were too debilitating. The fact that electric types can no longer be paralyzed didn't help, making it struggle with Zapdos and Rotom Wash even more than it had previously. Togekiss had quite a lot to offer, of course, but it just didn't have the speed or immediate oomph to make it work consistently. Then again, you could have all the speed and oomph in the world and still might not be enough, as in the case of Terrakion. Rock is classic coverage alongside Fighting Staff, but to have Stab on that rock coverage as well was just incredible. To have it on a Pokemon of Terrakion's power and speed, yep, that's how you got early Gen 5, where all those dragons running around had to bow in awe of the pulverization left in the wake of this monster. A Pokemon of Infernape's legendary speed stat with such incredible power was already a shock, and to have such beautifully complementary stabs as if designed to work in tandem as dangerously as possible was just incredible, especially since it could boost further with Swords Dance. Terrakion was set to eviscerate both offense and defense alike, and indeed, for a lengthy period of Black and White 1, it was thought by many to be broken. Its choice band Close Combat had already become one of the tier's most defining, terrifying moves. Terrakion never got its suspect test though, for similar reasons to why it eventually tapered off in Black and White 2. No, it wasn't about the introduction of Landers Therion. Matter of fact, having Landel T on your team was about the easiest way to trick yourself into thinking you were fine against Terrakion, when in reality, it usually took one Stone Edge for it to be trouble. The problem was that for all Terrakion's strength, and this will sound absurd, but hear me out, it wasn't quite fast enough or quite strong enough to compensate for its weaknesses. I know, how much stronger and faster do you need to be? Well, Terrakion needs to automatically destroy a lot to make up for the relatively limited opportunities it gets to switch in. It's not frail, and switch moves go a long way, but when you get this thing in, an opponent's Pokemon needs to be in danger of dropping. Otherwise, it'll take too long to get the value out of Terrakion, and it'll be revenge killed by the even faster, stronger Pokemon that were the norm all the way back in Gen 5, to say nothing of offensive teams with priority aplenty. So here's the exact problem. Terrakion is a one-hit KO machine when it's using Close Combat. This is unquestionably a move that deletes non-resist. The problem is that Stone Edge is not nearly as strong, making it difficult for it to reliably muscle through the bulkier fighting resists that are a necessity for any team looking to be halfway decent defensively. And those teams that aren't are the ones that are bombarding Terrakion with offense and priority. Basically, Terrakion is forced to spam Stone Edge, and Terrakion is a lot less scary. This isn't to suggest that Terrakion isn't one of the Pokemon most easily capable of sending an opposing team on the express train to Splitsville, because it is, and it's not even that there are that many Pokemon capable of matching it in this regard, because there aren't. However, those that do tend to challenge it for their greater overall utility, which is why Terrakion has struggled in the gens following the 5th, even though theoretically the Fairy type is just another fighting resist waiting to get Stone Edge. But that takes away from Terrakion's primary strength. Not a Pokemon you want to give any breathing room by any means, as anyone who's faced Swords Dance Terrakion with an unknown Z crystal in Gen 7 UU will tell you. It's just not quite what the early gushing would have suggested. It's a letdown, just like it was for Alolan Marowak. In early Gen 7 OU, Alolan Marowak was raved over by the player base. It wasn't just that it was an incredibly powerful physical attacker with superb dual stab, backed by perfect coverage and a great move pool, including Stealth Rock. Charizard, though it was. It was that the same typing that gave it such excellent stab also gave it a certain unique utility against some of the metagame's scariest elements. You'd think a Pokemon of such unimpressive base stat total wouldn't stand a chance in an OU as powerful as Gen 7, but Alolan Marowak seemed like the real deal. It managed to check the monstrously broken Feromosa, and it threatened the daylights out of Stall, which was dominant to the point of controversy, without being trapped by Dugtrio, as the ghost type had become immune to trapping abilities in Gen 6. Alolan Marowak became the Stall killer. Plus, with Lightning Rod, Alolan Marowak was an amazing check to Tapu Koko. Fire Ghost with an electric immunity is simply overflowing with defensive utility, and for this to be in service of such an offensive ferocity that was nigh unwallable was tremendous. So, what happened? Feromosa was banned, and so was Dugtrio, making Stall much easier to deal with, but that didn't seem like it would affect Alolan Marowak, as its innate qualities were just so good. Tapu Koko wasn't going anywhere, for instance. Be that as it may, those flaws everyone was willing to overlook early on out of excitement, and yes, necessity, were too much to manage. Even if Feromosa had stuck around, these flaws would have eventually been taken advantage of, because they were major. The fact of the matter is that Alolan Marowak possesses some of the worst flaws one could have. It is slow and weak to Stealth Rock. This is just about the easiest thing in the world to take advantage of. Thanks to the thick club it has to hold, it doesn't even get leftovers. It's also not even that bulky, certainly not on the special side. These flaws go beyond it disappointing in OU. They follow Alolan Marowak through every tier. It can have its moments, especially on a Trick Room team, but it's a lot of promise betrayed by its stats. A shame for such a unique Pokemon. A physical fire ghost type? Well, speaking of uniqueness, here's our finale with Nihiligo. As the otherworldly parasite that made Lusamine go full-on Mother Beast mode, still one of the coolest things that happened in a Pokemon game, expectations for Nihiligo were high, especially since it was one of the Ultra Beasts, and because it was such an interesting Pokemon. There's really nothing else like it. It's a strong, speedy special attacker that has Rock Poison as its typing, of all things, and is incredibly specially bulky to boot, with a colorful attacking move pool including Thunderbolt's excellent coverage and support in the form of Stealth Rock and Toxic Spikes. It's got the stats, it's got the moves, does it have the typing to deliver on that promise? Well, kinda. Being a grounded poison is amazing in a world where Toxapex is constantly laying down its own T-spikes. Being able to absorb them is wonderful support, and there's always going to be use for a strong special attacker that can also take some hits. And the difference between Nihiligo and Heatran is that Nihiligo's speed stat is genuinely superb, with its base 103 seemingly designed explicitly to get the jump on Garchomp. You can thus run a pretty strong Choice Scarf set with it, and it's actually a great check to the eternally dangerous Volcarona. Plus, Poison Staff threatens the daylight out of the four Tapus now ruling OU. There's a lot to like, and indeed, Nihiligo saw a good chunk of usage early on. But sadly, while it was certainly not a bad Pokemon, it didn't quite perform the competitive equivalent of the number it did on Lusamine. While Rock Poison typing is certainly interesting and had a unique set of upsides, it also had many, many exploitable weaknesses. Nihiligo's non-existent physical defense was a major factor too. It's a familiar story by this point. Decent, sure, but not quite speedy or strong or otherwise impactful with utility to be any more than that. It's a great Yu-Yu Pokemon, no question, but you kind of wish Mother Beast Nihiligo would burst onto the scene. And thank you so much to our Platinum patrons. Thank you to Amphozenus, Alex Sable, Anthony Belval Renault, Bingleton, Daniel Isbeast, Corman, Eric Dissing, Funky, Glitcherton, Howl, Jack G, King Yabber, Nightfall, Megamon VGC, Mojo Gameslayer, Nurse Jake, Pretzel SP, Soljiro Sakura, Spavoon, Gylaria, Soars and Croxen, Shiwei Miji, Stoneface Colin, Kiboflu, Wardine, for their major support of our videos.